Good morning, folks. I want to welcome you all to the School for Successful Ranching. My name is Bert Barnes, and I'll be moderating the session today. At this time, I would like to ask you to place all your cell phones on silent and remove your hats. Also, with this in this session, please keep your cell phones out. It is an interactive session where you will be using and texting with your phone. We would like to take this time to also thank our generous sponsors of this School for Successful Ranching for their support of this program and commitment to producer education. They have small displays set up in the hallways on the floor, and we ask that you visit their booths in the expo and just say a little thank you. We couldn't have done this program without them. The sponsors include Capital Farm Credit, Cattlemen's Education Series, Cortiva, Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo, Lone Star Ag Credit, Positive Feeds, Raybo Agrofinance, Stay Tough Fence Manufacturing, and Texas Beef Quality Assurance. Our first presentation is Herd Health Calendar Development with Dr. John Davidson and Dr. Bud Dinges with Beringer and Ingelheim. Please join me in welcoming our speakers.
Well, good morning. Can y'all hear me okay? Good deal. Well, I want to welcome y'all to the TSCRA School of for Successful Ranching. It's a great platform, in my opinion, for producers to visit, learn some information that they can take back home to their operations and to your operations and instill those and allow your production or your operation to be more productive and profitable, hopefully. My name is Bud Dinges. I think the TSCRA is a great organization. They work day in and day out to promote the ranching way of life and promote the beef industry and protect our liberties and capabilities of producing beef for our consumption. I have been involved with TSCRA for quite a few years. My family have been members since before I was born. In my adult life, I was able to take part in some of the committee activities, work my way up through committee leadership, and ultimately be put on the board of directors. Life is full of opportunities. About a year ago, I was afforded the opportunity to go to work for Beringer Ingelheim as a beef cattle professional services veterinarian. Beringer Ingelheim is the largest independently owned animal health company in the world, based out of Ingelheim, Germany. The company was formed back in 1885, and we're a company that believes in prevention works. We would like to prevent disease, that way we don't have to treat it. Our motto is putting cattle first, and I know many of you out there, that's your what you strive to do each and every day. I know I did growing up ranching on the Gulf Coast. My dad was a firm believer. He said, if you take care of your cattle, the cattle will take care of you. And we had some animal health protocols and production medicine and management practices that we use day in and day out, year in and year out in our ranching operation. And I think Dr. Davidson has put together several animal health practices and production medicine and management practices that y'all can take back home and place in your operations today. So this is Dr. John Davidson.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Bud. Dr. Dinges and I travel all over the United States talking with producers, veterinarians, future veterinarians, animal scientists. We believe in identifying opportunities to improve efficiency in all of your operations, and it's great to see a full room this morning for this hour-long session. This is an interactive session, so we'll have several questions, which we would appreciate all of you that are interested in participating. We have no way of knowing whose responses, who is who. It's completely anonymous, but we'd like you to participate, and we think these opportunities create more engagement. At the end of the session, our hope and our expectation is that you will take away from this session how important it is to have a functional, practical herd health calendar, something that you have that is easily accessible that you can update it anytime you hear something that's new, some new science comes out that challenges conventional wisdom, and I'll share with you some of those ideas this morning. So the considerations when you're putting together a heart health calendar, your marketing goals. Is your end point stripping calves off the cows, taking them to town, and then that's pretty much the end of your cycle, get the cows bred again and repeat? Do you have opportunity to retain ownership and take them all the way to harvest? And I'll share with you some information about some producers that we've worked with and some opportunities for adding some things to the herd health calendar that might not be top of mind for all of you. Your risk tolerance. Preventive medicine is very much like insurance. I know you look at the end of the year, you look at how much you spend on preventive medicine, dewormers, vaccines, diagnostic tests, and so on. You think, my gosh, we spent a lot of money last year. But when you compare the cost of prevention versus economic wrecks, when you have respiratory disease outbreaks, pink eye outbreaks, abortion storms, venereal diseases like trichomoniasis and so on introduced into your cattle operation, then it makes the inputs that you put in economically, they balance out. Record keeping. You need to keep good records. You've heard me say this here before. You can't manage when you don't have the data, you can't really manage it. Facilities. How much of the things we talk about today, is it practical for you and your operation to be able to put the cattle through? Do you have enough labor to handle the cattle, the times that it takes to, for particularly some of these operations? We'll talk about, spend some time talking about heifers and improving reproductive efficiency with our females to get us more pounds of calf weaned per female exposed, which is the most critical metric for any cow-calf operation out there, is pounds of calf weaned per female exposed. How many of you in the room today can tell me your pounds of calf weaned per female exposed for 2017, 2018? Get them up. If you can do it, get them up. I want to see them. That's great. How many of you can tell me the miles per gallon in your diesel pickup that's parked out across the street in the hotel? Which one's worth more money, your cattle operation or your truck? Okay, point made. All right, here's your first opportunity. Get your telephones out. For the millennials in the room, this is no problem. So you are going to, the address that you're texting to is 22333. And then in the text box, you're going to text TSCRA.
All right, first question. High-performing operations reduce health inputs during declining markets. High-performing operations reduce health inputs during declining markets.
Okay, we see the general trend. The numbers will continue to change as you get your inputs in, and thank you for participating. It'll be the same format. You'll just click A, B, or C, depending on the question format. What is the answer? The reality is that high-performing operations do not reduce their health inputs during declining markets, and this is information coming from CattleFax. So high-return producers do not compromise on animal health, nutrition, genetics, and marketing. When you look at the 11 habits of high-return producers, and I'm sure many of you have seen this before, it's probably been presented here before, but relevant to this conversation this morning, higher average weaning weights, higher conception rates, more pounds of calf weaned per female exposed, and preventive herd health programs. Those are critical. And all of those things really are tied to what we're talking about this morning. If you do not have these herd health practices and events on your calendar where you're thinking about them, planning them, they won't be executed. So what is the relationship to profitability? Percent calf weaned? Pounds at weaning? Price per pound? So I put this graphic together years ago, and I get a similar response each time I ask the following question, but what do you influence as a producer? How many of those supporting areas do you influence as the producer responsible for the operation?
All right, question number two. As a producer, which of the components can I influence? A, percentage calf crop. B, weaning weight. C, price per pound. Or D, all of the above.
All right, poll is full and no longer accepting responses. Thank you for participating. Let me get you to think about something. If you market a uniform set of cattle and you've communicated the health program that you have for your cattle operation, will that influence the price per pound? Yes, it will. So the answer for this one is really all of the above. All right, so let me take you back to 1966. Dr. Bellows wrote a paper called Increasing Pounds of Calf Wean per Cow Bred. It's one of my favorite quotes in all the work I do because it's pretty simple and it communicates really important thing for a cow-calf producer. Lifetime production is dependent on the first record, and what he's talking about is when that heifer has her first calf. So let's talk about some things that influence that. Another question for you.
Breeding soundness exams in heifers can improve lifetime production in the operation. A, true, B, false.
How many of you in your herd health calendar for the year's activities do breeding sound, have your veterinarian do breeding soundness examinations or track scoring on your heifers? Get your hand up if you do it. I want to see. Okay. How many of you would pay $3 to your local practitioner to get an extra year of productivity out of the females on your operation? How many of you would pay $3 to get an extra year of productivity out of your operation? You would, right? Okay. That is what, that is really one of the health, that's a critical health input that's missing from the overwhelming majority of calendars, and that's why I wanted to bring that up today. Pounds of calf weaned can be improved by higher pregnancy rates, first service conception rates, decrease your losses either at calving or before weaning, increase your calf weaning weights. Heifer breeding soundness exams, reproductive tract scoring, influence preg rates, first service conception rates, and overall calf weaning weights. So here's some more scientific support for that. So a 10-year-long study at the United States Meat Animal Research Center in Clay Center, Nebraska, almost 17,000 heifers involved, and they were tracked based on when they had their first calf. In the first 21 days of the calving season, the second 21 days, or the third 21 days. Those heifers that had their first calf in the first 21 days of the calving season, or in other words, those heifers that conceived during their first cycle after exposure to the bull, remained in that herd for 8.2 years, which was a full year longer than just a 42-day delay in conception. Okay? And we can select, there's a lot of reasons, a lot of criteria that you have for selecting a heifer. Genetics, phenotype, how does she look? I would advise that from a productive standpoint, if you're not track scoring and using that data as a key element of your retention program, you're missing an opportunity to improve your efficiency. In addition, the first five calves out of those heifers that had calves in the first 21 days of the calving season were statistically significantly heavier than the heifers' calves in the second and third groups. That influenced total pounds weaned and average weaning weight, and you can see this in the graph. This was published in the Journal of Animal Science. So from the first five calves, it evened out and normalized at about calf six. But longevity in those females takes a lot of money to develop a female. I would encourage you to put that track scoring on your calendar, and we'll walk through a sample calendar here in a few minutes. Reproductive track scoring. Scale of 1 to 5, you want to keep 3s, 4s, and 5s. You are selecting against subfertile females. Same principle that applies to breeding soundness exams in the bull. We don't really care if a bull is 72% normal sperm cells or 87% normal sperm cells. We care that they're greater than 70%. We are selecting against subfertility. Same principle applies here as well. There's economics behind it. Besides what I just shared with you, one of our colleagues at BI, Dr. Doug Inslee, wrote this paper when he was working at the University of Georgia. So here, this puts some numeric values to the differences in the track scoring. And basically, a track score of 5, she just demonstrates her ovaries, her reproductive track, demonstrates more clinical evidence of sexual maturity and cycling ability and capacity than those that, say, are a 1 or a 2, for example. But a heifer with a track score of 5 had an average calving date 16 days sooner than that of a 4, and 35 days or a full month earlier than a track score of 3. So that track score 3 female probably was around the time the bulls were being turned out, getting ready to cycle, showing evidence of sexual maturity. In this situation, you can look at the average gain of those calves from 16 to 35 days, having them on your place a little longer. That clearly translates into heavier weights and increased opportunity for return. So you have to have a plan. A colleague of ours, Dr. Glenn Rogers, was an early mentor of mine, actually one of the primary influencers into me going into industry. And when I was teaching at Texas A&M, I had him come in and speak to a class that I was teaching. And this is a really concise way to look at building a herd health calendar. And so I've wanted to give him credit for this opportunity here. So number one, please work with your beef cattle-oriented practitioner. I would tell you that many of you are very experienced and can doctor your own cattle and are good at and adept at recognizing disease and so on, but those highly efficient operations are also those that have a close working relationship with their beef cattle-oriented veterinarian. First critical step, you've got to know when you're going to market your cattle. Determine the optimum time of year for breeding and calving seasons. You kind of work backwards. Determine the optimal length of your breeding season. How aggressive do you want to be? The more aggressive you are with your breeding season, it creates opportunities to handle cattle at different times where you will have more females open, for example, where you can do some pre-breeding herd health inputs to minimize the potential impact of venereal diseases and also diseases like BVD, persistently infected cattle. Become more knowledgeable about the specific diseases and parasites that are economically significant in the area. There are lots of diseases out there that you can attempt to prevent with a herd health calendar, lots of products that you could insert into your protocol. My recommendation to you is know the true economically important diseases and threats in your area, in your region where you run your cattle operation. Match your calendar, match your protocol to those disease threats. Determine the best time to administer preventative measures for each disease and condition. And if you're frantically writing all these down, I'll just tell you, I will I didn't have the slide set finished in time to get everyone a set of bound notes. Who paid for the notes, the proceedings for the conference? I'm happy to get you a set of mine. I will email a PDF to Stacy, and Stacy will email it to you. You don't have to scribble down to get all this. If you want to come by the BI booth later and get us your email address, again, I'm happy to email you these so you don't have to feverishly write everything down. Select specific products that have research-proven efficacy, the best data available, and a track record of product support. One of the things that Dr. Dingus and I do for Boehringer Ingelheim is we interact with producers and veterinarians primarily to improve their health and efficiency in their cattle operations, but when there's an issue, one of our jobs is to step in and make sure things are taken care of. Determine additional measures needed and package health management practices into a limited number of events. It's a compromise. I could write a herd health program for you where you would be touching cattle every 3 weeks, and nobody's going to do that. It has to be practical. So there's a give and take on a lot of things, but the critical economic drivers, the productive drivers, we shouldn't compromise on those. And the goal of today's presentation is to put it all together in a document that you can refer to on a regular basis. Whether it's in your kitchen at your ranch or in your out by your pens in the chute where you might, around the chute where you keep your animal health products cold and so on, I would encourage you to have three things stuck on the bulletin board or around the refrigerator out there in your hospital area. One is the phone number for your veterinarian if you don't already have it in your phone. Two would be your herd health calendar, and three would be the pounds of calf weaned per female exposed for the prior calendar year, and this is your benchmark for something that you want to try to surpass and eclipse. Lastly, provide periodic updates, and that's why you're here. You're at the School of Successful Ranching, want to improve your opportunities for success, and we're going to share with you a few concepts to put all that together this morning. So, these are some things probably going to challenge some traditional thinking. Many of you might have the same general calendar, whether it's written down or not. You might be doing the same things you've been doing for 20 years. We'll challenge your thinking on some things. Early vaccination. When I was in veterinary school, when Dr. Dingus was in veterinary school, any other veterinarians in the room today? We were taught that when you vaccinate a young calf that had an adequate transfer of immunity from the cow or heifer through colostrum, that those antibodies will interfere with that calf's ability to produce new immunity as a result of vaccination. There are some limitations with maternal antibody interference, but generally speaking, for viral diseases like BVD, and even clostridial diseases, we can vaccinate a calf, a young calf, younger than we thought previously, and still get a strong immune response and a protective immunity. So this is one of the concepts that I'm going to recommend to you, that we can actually, in the herd health calendar, we can delete the pre-weaning handling or processing event and move some of the respiratory vaccines into that marking or branding age calf, delete the pre-weaning opportunity, and then work them again at weaning. I'll show you the support behind that. So this would apply to virals, clostridials. The first work in this area was 11 years ago out of Oklahoma State. One of the authors on that paper, Dr. D.L. Stepp, was a longtime faculty member at Oklahoma State, now works on our team, our beef cattle team at BI. Their treatment groups in that study, they had three treatment groups. They received vaccines at branding and weaning, or 67 days of age on average and 190 days of age on average, or a traditional pre-weaning weaning age group, 167 and 190, or the ages of the two respective vaccine treatments, or no respiratory vaccine till they arrived at the feed yard. In that study, there was minimal illness at the ranch of origin. Feedlot BRD treatments were the same for the two vaccination groups. It did not matter whether they were on the traditional pre-weaning weaning program or moving the modified live viral vaccine up earlier in that nursing calf's life. What was really interesting in that study also was the, let me tell you about this one. Similar study, modeled similarly in terms of ages. This is University of Arkansas. Dr. John Richardson is now at West Texas, or Texas A&M at Canyon. In this particular study, these were Angus cross beef calves, the youngest of which in the early group were 45 days of age. The average was 62 days. They were the traditional group had received its first dose at 188 days, and then they were all worked at the weaning age of roughly 210 days of age. They were preconditioned. In the feedlot, health and growth performances were the same. They were identical. There was no impact in moving that modified live respiratory vaccine up to an average of 62 days of age. And again, the youngest calf in this study was 45 days of age. So the youngest calf would have been worked at 45 days of age, and then again at about 210 days of age. Interestingly enough, for BBD, which is a critical viral disease affecting not only cow-calf operations, but stocker operations, confinement operations around the United States and really around the world, the antibody production for the calves in this study was greatest for those calves that received the vaccine earlier in life. And that truly challenges conventional thinking in terms of maternal antibody interference. So on the heels of that research, I worked with Superior Livestock to get them to edit the language on their VAC45 program. And I know it's hard to see on this slide, but for about a year now, the language at branding has been on the VAC45 program. So leading marketing programs around the country recognize early vaccination is a useful tool for a cow-calf operation. Okay,
Got another question for you. Which type of BVD is most common in the U.S.? A, BVD type 1A? Answer B, BVD type 1B? Answer C, BVD type 2? Answer D, BVD has not been diagnosed in the United States.
Okay, interesting results. The answer is actually 23% that participated, got it right. So if you got it right, you can pat yourself on the back. BVD1B is the most common subgenotype of BVD in the U.S. today. Here's a study. This was done at Oklahoma State University. Over 22,000 cattle were tested. Those that were PI, 78% of them were BVD1Bs. This is data out of TVMDL in Amarillo, Texas. If you, on the left side, the first column is the proportions of BVD subgenotypes in 1988. So you can see the BVD 1As there were 51%, BVD 1Bs were 41%, and then BVD type 2 were 8%. And look at the shift from 88 to 98. From 98 to 2008, I can tell you that right now at BI, we are, our territory managers, our sales reps are taking BVDPI samples from all across the United States. We're sending them to a laboratory for typing. The cost of typing has come down substantially since the going back to 20 and 30 years ago. Three-quarters of the BVDPIs that we're getting our hands on are BVD1Bs, which is pretty consistent with what you see here. far and away the most important subgenotype of BVD out there is BVD1B. So my challenge to you, as you start getting ready to prepare your herd health calendar and thinking about one of the nine steps is matching the products that you're selecting with the present and currently available science and economic data. Producers seldom read the label on the products that they use. When's the last time you read a label for a vaccine that's in your program? Good. Okay. There might be folks in a room that haven't read a label in years. And reading the label, I know it's a bunch of fine print, but the critical thing, what I want to show you here, for example, take the package insert out and see, particularly on your modified live viral vaccines, how does your modified live viral vaccine line up against the current economic threat, for example, BVD1B? Is BVD1B anywhere on the label for the viral vaccines that are in your program? Also, particularly with regard to modified live viral vaccines, make sure that your program, that you're on label with regard to administration of the modified live viral vaccines to pregnant females. Follow the label with regard to administration prior to breeding if you're going to use modified live viral vaccines. Prevent the BVDPI calf. So you might hear discussion about, well, we use our vaccines, we've done BVD studies and challenge studies, what are the results? How do the results of the studies compare against the most common subgenotype of BVD? For example, in this particular summary on a modified live viral vaccine Express FP, you can see over 95% of the fetuses were protected against type 1B and type 2A challenge. So this is probably one of the most interesting papers I've read in the last 10 years. And we're going to do a survey on it. Before Bud asks the question, I'll kind of set this thing up. There are many different modified live viral vaccines available to you as a cattle producer. They are the recipe for how they are produced, the amount of viral antigen that's in the bottle, whether they are adjuvanted or not, the strains of BVD, for example, that are in there. They are all different across all the manufacturers. They're safe, they're efficacious, they would not be on the market otherwise. Okay? But for a long time, there's a couple of products out there that for a long time have been touting that they had a strain of BVD, which is the NADL, which is National Animal Disease Laboratory in Ames, Iowa. Large laboratory that was opened in the 1960s. They isolated a strain of BVD. It was attenuated and made safe for use in vaccines. And the question then is, using the same strain in cows and calves, is that scientifically justified? Should you be one-stop shop with using the same viral vaccine? I've had questions posed to me in the past. Should I give different viral vaccines, show different antigens to my cattle? And this paper, and I'll walk you through how the paper was done, but prior to, I want to ask the question.
Okay, it's a true-false question. For optimal BVD type 1A and 1B antibody production in vaccinated calves, my herd health program should use BVD vaccine containing the NADL strain in both cows and calves. True or false?
This is the most technical question we'll ask today. Okay. Thanks again for participating. I like we're so starting to narrow the, making a comeback with the truths. All right. The answer is false. And here's the research. This was published 3 years ago. This was not sponsored by any manufacturer. This was done at Auburn University. They actually have a tremendous team of BVD researchers in Auburn, Alabama. In this study, they took a northern Alabama beef cow-calf operation, and took the cows were on a modified live viral vaccine using a common and probably leading modified live viral vaccine. The calves were pulled off and split into different treatment groups, receiving either the same viral vaccine that the cows received or different brands of modified live viral vaccines. The antibodies to those in those calves were measured, and then those cattle were exposed to BVDPI calves. And those calves were analyzed, their blood was analyzed to see if they became viremic. And viremic is a technical term for the presence of virus circulating in their blood. That's what a viremia is. So these cattle, after 45 days after vaccination, to allow for a robust immune response, they were commingled with PI calves and also some herpes virus or red nose IBR infected calves, and they were commingled for 28 days, which is a strong exposure. There were, on the BVDPI cattle that were in that challenge study, they were 2 1As, 2 1Bs, and 2 type 2s, so pretty even distribution of the subgenotypes that we have in the United States today. And here are the interesting results. So the black bars that you see, the really tall ones, are the controls. Those are the cattle, the calves that did not receive any vaccine. So it makes sense that when they were exposed to BVDPI calves, many of those cattle had viremias or virus circulating in their blood. But what was most interesting to me in this particular study was the calves that received the same vaccine as the cows had the lowest pre-challenge antibodies to BVD, meaning the maternal antibodies from the colostrum from the cow from her prior vaccination, the antibodies being specifically geared towards the vaccine that the calves then received, wiped out much of those antibodies or much of the vaccine to reduce the antibody production, and this was impressive to me from the standpoint because that is so common. If you're on a modified live viral vaccine program, which you give the cows, you're probably going to give the calves. How many of you do that? If you're using a modified live viral vaccine in your operation, how many of you are giving the same viral vaccine to the calves that you do to your cows? Okay. So this work was really interesting from that standpoint. And here's a direct quote from the authors. Because calves in Group D were vaccinated with the same vaccine as their dams, we believe that the maternally derived and anti-BVD antibodies in those calves might have partially inactivated the vaccine virus and limited the induction of antibodies against BVD. Really neat work. So the takeaway there is, when you're visiting with your veterinarian about your herd health protocol, you need to talk about research like this and identify opportunities to improve your program to match threats like BVD. At the outset, I made the statement that we need to match our protocols to economically important diseases, parasitism being one, viral diseases like BVD being another. When do we place clostridials? Yes?
Ask two quick questions. One is, so what you're saying is you use a different model, right?
Correct.
The other question is, I'll jump back a few slides. When y'all were talking about you and your back program, were they doing the program where they gave the vaccination and then booster, or just gave that vaccine shot and then boosted when they weaned?
It was just two rounds. So basically what we've done, and it'll be visual for you when I put the calendar up, but instead of roughly 30 days apart between pre-weaning and weaning, or weaning post-weaning, we're stretching those apart and moving that first opportunity up to branding. Okay? You bet. Appreciate the question. Next question, and this one's not interactive necessarily, just something to think about. If I'd had more time to create more questions, the question thing gave me a little bit of a problem last night and this morning, but I would ask you, how many of you believe that you need to give clostridial vaccines to adult cattle in your operation? And I hope that 100% of you would say, yes, we need to. And the other would be, how many of you, when you've read the label on the clostridial products that you're using, follow the label and give two rounds of clostridial or blackleg vaccines to your calves. And I hope that 100% of you would say, yes, we've read the label, and we either use two doses of a two-dose product or a single dose of a single-dose blackleg. This was a Journal of Animal Science 12 years ago, and this really supports when I put together a herd health calendar, I like to see clostridial vaccines go into cows at PregCheck. Why? Because it stimulates antibody production, and then as she prepares to calve, those antibodies are concentrated into colostrum, and that calf gets the benefit of clostridial disease protection for several weeks, if not months, of its life until you then administer a clostridial vaccine directly into that calf, okay? Anything you put in that cow prior to calving, it's almost a two-for-one in terms of antibody production and benefit to that nursing calf. And it's conditional. That calf has to get adequate amount of high-quality colostrum. Okay. So in this particular study, the cows were vaccinated 120 days before calving, and what it did is it definitely stimulated antibody production in those in the cows, which transferred via colostrum to the calves. And just as a reminder that when we think about where we're going to place a herd health input like blackleg vaccine in our adult cattle, PregCheck is a good opportunity to do that. Okay, and this one's just for my, just to kind of read the room. I think this is the last survey question we have, but I just want to see which camp you're in. Are you in the killed modified live camp? Maybe I should have had option C or both, but go ahead, bud.
All right. Question is, for my annual cow viral vaccine, my cattle receive A, a modified live virus vaccine, or B, killed, inactivated viral vaccine?
I figured this one might be pretty evenly split. Hey, that wasn't even an option, and somebody figured that out. Great. I guess you can put C in. Okay. Thank you. That's good. Good info. Like to have that. That's good. All right, let's talk about calendar development. So this is really, I wanted to give you some concepts to challenge your thinking, and now we'll put it all. Recognize that the dates, when bulls go in, how long they stay in, when they come out, that drives everything. And where the dates fall on the calendar might not fit your operation. It's the concepts here that I'm hopefully stimulating some thought as you prepare. This is modeled after a very good friend of mine. Review his health calendar on a regular basis with him, and this is pretty much what we have working his operation. So he calves in September. End of calving in early November. So that drives when the bulls go in, when the bulls are picked up. Critical point. Trichomoniasis is the most economically important disease for a cow-calf producer in the Gulf Coast of the United States. I would say probably true all the way up to South Dakota, and then as you go to the Western Range states, it's important. Oftentimes, the diagnosis of trich is not discovered until a significant outbreak, and we have either abortions or lost pregnancies, or at gathering, we don't have the number of calves matching the number of cows we have. I've worked with lots of herds that have trich, as has Dr. Dingett, and I would just recommend that if you are in an endemic area for trich, or you have neighbors around you that have high-risk cattle, or you purchase additions of unknown source and disease status, I would do post-breeding surveillance on your bulls by pasture to make sure that you haven't had trich introduced into a set of cows. PregCheck. Some folks like to ultrasound and do things early. Some do it a little bit later. So there's a broad window there on when you can do the preg checking. But that's a great time to, you've got the cattle in the chute. It's a great time to deworm them. It's a great time to administer vaccinations. And again, and so the preg check opportunity for me and with adult cows and heifers is I'd like to see a blackleg go in there for the reasons that we've talked about. I think lepto, for me personally, I like to see lepto go in twice a year. I know we have products in the industry that have year-long duration of immunity on lepto. I think the lepto challenge in our cattle in this part of the country is very high, and I recommend leptospirosis vaccination twice yearly in cattle operations when you put them through the chute.
What about Hargio?
Leptohargiobovis. Leptohargiobovis was diagnosed in Louisiana in 1960. It's actually the only strain of lepto that, for cattle that is truly indigenous to the United States. Yes, leptohargiobovis is, and when you look at the spectrum, there's two main leptos we worry about in cattle. One is Leptopomona, that is classically a late pregnancy, mid to late term abortion storm type lepto. Leptohargiobovis actually affects the full reproductive cycle of the cow. Who asked the question? Okay, so Leptohargiobovis, and I probably should have been particular on that, or should have specified on the slide. When I say lepto, I mean vaccinating, making sure you have label indications for Leptohargiobovis. Thank you for the question. Virals. If you're doing pre-breeding modified live virals that are covering you for a year, then that's fine. Make sure if you're using a modified live, for example, you need to make sure you're on label. When the safety claims for modified lives became prevalent in around 2003, 2004, there was a lot of noise about abortion storms and lost pregnancies. And the overwhelming majority of those pregnancies that were lost to modified live viral vaccines were in cattle that were not vaccinated appropriately, pre-breeding. Okay, modified live viral vaccines are safe around pregnant females, provided you've done your part and followed the label, which is prior to giving it preg check, they need to be given pre-breeding. Okay? Scour vaccines, if you have a herd history of scours. Scours vaccines work in an identical way to the clostridial discussion that we had about protecting that calf. You vaccinate the cow, she produces antibodies to the vaccines. Those antibodies are transferred via colostrum, absorbed into that calf's gut in the first 12 hours of life, and then that calf basically is protected for a period of time, along with other good sound management practices, rotating calving pastures and things like that. And, of course, deworming is a great opportunity at preg check. Fall deworming, and that can be a long range. I'm a believer in strategic deworming. I like to use our seasons to support when we're going to get the benefit. Of course, the fall, you can move that deworming anywhere you need to, maybe even if you're in northern tiers of the country after a good hard frost where the pasture burdens have been reduced somewhat. In the spring, you know, of course, it's no secret, BI acquired Mariel a little over two years ago, and we're excited about the long-range product, which fits in the spring really well in terms of matching the extended growing season, and the parasite burdens in pastures generally and exposure rates are greater as that grass is growing green and growing, and so with adequate moisture, that threat remains long, and we think that's a great opportunity for that product there. Breeding soundness exams. Bulls, and as I talked to you earlier on, please put track scoring and breeding soundness exams on your replacement heifers on your calendar. It'll improve your opportunity to increase your pounds of calf weaned per female exposed and longevity and lifetime production in that set of females that you've invested so much in. Pre-breeding vaccinations fall in there, and so here's the pre-breeding opportunity. Heifer breeding soundness exam, bull breeding soundness exam. You'll notice the terminology there. Because of bovine spongiform encephalopathy, I never want people to be confused about what we're talking about. So there's a movement in veterinary medicine to call the bull breeding soundness exam, not just the BSE, and that creates the opportunity for the heifer breeding soundness exam terminology as well. When you have those bulls in the squeeze chute, for the same reasons I told you about post-breeding trick surveillance, I would also strongly encourage you to know the trick status of every bull going into your pasture. A bull's ticket to change pastures, if you're rotating bulls around, if you have two breeding seasons, two calving seasons, don't move bulls, one bull battery to another pasture without a negative trick test. Vaccinate pre-breeding against venereal diseases, trick, Campylobacter. Campy is not as common as much anymore, but I hear about sporadic cases around the country, and when they hit, if the cattle aren't adequately prepared, they can be as devastating as trick. Viral vaccinations. The big four, BVD, IBR, PI3, BRSV. And we have the opportunity to prevent the BVD PI calf. Just as a, how are we doing on time? Okay, perfect. I'll take 30 seconds and just remind you. So for those of you that are not familiar with the terminology, BVDPI calves, persistently infected calves, are created when females that are pregnant are exposed to the BVD virus and they are less than 125 or so days pregnant. The immune system in that fetal calf is not developed yet. The virus gets into the blood of that female, it goes to the uterus, it gets to the fetus. When that fetal calf is exposed to the BVD virus prior to 125 to 150 days, if the pregnancy is not lost or aborted, then that calf will survive and that calf will be permanently infected or persistently infected and shed BVD virus every day of its life. And you cannot, unless they have other congenital malformations, there's brain lesions, eye lesions, blood situations that can happen. But if there are not congenital issues with that calf, you will not be able to tell outwardly if that calf is a PI or not. The BVD-PI phenomenon is a significant issue for our industry overall, for cow-calf operations impacting reproduction, for our stocker and feeder operations. It is a significant contributor to bovine respiratory disease complex. It is immunosuppressive, weakens the calf's immune system. They become more vulnerable and susceptible to bacterial diseases like Mannheimia hemolytica, Pasteurella multocida. Yes, ma'am.
Maybe an elementary question, but how is that transmitted? I have a very small closed herd, and only one fence line where there's other
animals that
I suspect
are not. Okay, fair question, and there's nothing too elementary. You're in a school for successful ranching, right? So It is a viral disease. It is spread by contact with infected, could be saliva, other bodily fluids will carry the virus as well. The thing that's unique about BVDPI calves is they shed such high amounts of the virus. So drinking out of a stock tank or pond, there can be enough viral transmission in that water to where other cattle drinking out of that same water source can get exposed. If your question is about risk of exposure, I would also caution you in that wildlife, such as white-tailed deer, can vector BVD. And so when I've had producers tell me in the past, well, I've got great biosecurity, I don't really have risk of certain diseases, so you don't have any feral hogs on your operations in terms of lepto, you don't have white-tailed deer moving through your place in terms of BVD, you don't have migratory waterfowl coming in terms of salmonella and things like that. So a true enclosed biosecure operation is really hard to have, to be quite frank. Appreciate the question. Well, so a sneezing calf, it can aerosolize and it can travel some distance, but it's not hundreds of yards. You know, they need to be relatively close. And then, of course, the bacterial threats such as lepto. Technically, campy is a bacteria, but I have it up there with venereal diseases. All right. preventing the PI calf. Just a plug. That's my reminder. Is that 5 minutes? Okay. Just a plug. It's the only product on the market. So Trick Guard also comes with Vibrio and Lepto. If you're in a ranching in a trick endemic area, the timing on this one, I have this in here strictly just to educate you on the timing of this product. It is not a preg check vaccine. Okay, it's a pre-breeding vaccine. It's designed to cover the maximum exposure, which is infected bulls covering vulnerable females. All right, where are we? Branding. Branding, pre-weaning, weaning. We've talked about that. Marketing. All right, so here, historically, we were touching calves 3 times. What I'm telling you today is you can delete that middle opportunity. So traditional branding looked like this, black leg. Traditional pre-weaning, give a first round of virals. Hopefully we're including a gram-negative respiratory Mannheimia hemolytica, the number one killer of cattle in confinement in this country. Deworming, plus or minus implants, depending on how you're marketing your cattle. If you are marketing at the auction barn, or you're not trying to get in certain programs, you are missing a tremendous opportunity for added pounds if you're not implanting your calves. I'll just leave it at that. Weaning would look very similar depending on what inputs are going in at what time. What I'm suggesting to you today is you can delete that pre-weaning opportunity, and now we have what I would say is evidence-based branding, giving that clostridial, early viral vaccination, a Mannheimia, and you'll see Lepto pop up there. How is leptospirosis transmitted in a cow-calf operation? It's that carrier female, and that goes to your Leptoharjobovis question. The difference between Leptopomona and Leptoharjobovis is Leptoharjobovis, the bovine, is actually the carrier animal, whereas other species of animals are the carriers for Pomona. Leptoharjobovis, the bovine, is technically the carrier. They will carry that vaccine, they will carry that disease around and never mount a strong immune response. So when you have that Lepto HB carrier female, when does she expose her calf? As soon as she urinates on his head when he's nursing. All right? It happens that quick. When we do Lepto challenge studies, we take one tiny little dropper of Lepto-laden urine and drop it on the white of the eye of the calves in our studies. And 100% of them get sick with Lepto. So it's also a zoonotic disease, which means that if you're doing cow work on the back end of cows, you might be doing some AI or palpating or something like that. It's not innocuous to, when you get urinated on, you need to be careful because you do not want leptospirosis yourself. It can make you really sick. So I've removed the traditional pre-weaning out of the program. Here's one parting thought. There's some other opportunities out there. There's some really talented people in our industry. This is Donnie Roberts. He travels, he's from Florida, travels all over the country, ultrasounding cattle, and here he is in an operation where the producer decided he wanted to improve the carcass characteristics of the cattle that he was feeding at a feedlot in Kansas. And so the criteria, in addition to track scoring, an added criteria for this commercial operation was IMF. And so here's Donnie ultrasounding the backs of these cattle. And I called this producer last night and said, send me your most recent harvest data. 25% of the cattle that they harvested were prime, and the other 3/4 were high choice and choice. No selects. And all this is the function, I won't tell you what they're paying for this. It's really the premiums they're getting for the carcasses, the quality of the cattle that they're turning out. It's just one other thing that you can put on your calendar to create some opportunities if you're willing to go the distance with them. So surround yourself with people that are passionate about improving carcass quality, pounds of beef, efficiencies. There's a lot of dollars being left on the table in a lot of cattle operations that I see all across the United States. Okay? It'd be like having that V10 Dodge only firing on 7 cylinders. There's no excuse for that, okay? We can do more. We can do better. And it all starts by having it on a piece of paper that you can refer to. Keep records. Have a processing map. Know your withdrawal times. The products that you've got, source serial numbers, lot numbers, dosages, route of administration. Please get BQA certified if you are not already. BI has been a big supporter of BQA. I know Dr. Gill is here, had the honor of presenting him the BQA Educator of the Year a couple years ago at NCBA. And don't be that guy with the hotshot. All right, so I know we're at our time. Any questions? Yes, ma'am. I never intended. So we obviously use killed viral vaccines too. We have products in that category. I would tell you that there's nothing wrong with killed viral vaccines, but it's critical that you do two doses, and the timing of killed viral vaccines is really critical. Not going out, you know, like we can spread the modified lives out a little further. 30 days apart. 30 days apart is really important on killed viral vaccines. Because of the way the antibody production is, it's ideal to be 30 days apart on a killed viral vaccine. And I appreciate you asking the question. Okay, thank you all for attending.